Welcome to the Biota.org Interviews Podcast. This is part of the special series taken from the audio of the Biota 2 conference. Today's speaker is Larry Yeager.
I'm going to give a little bit unusual talk, certainly for me and probably for anyone. I usually do in artificial life talks specifically pretty much stick to the polyworld computational ecology work that I've done and talk about specific examples of, that have emerged in their species and behaviors and so on. But I am going to try to instead take some of the things I've learned from this and dive into what are life and mind. So, what is life? Mankind's been pondering this for about as long as we've been alive. And a lot of attempted answers have come down the pike, and in some ineffable product of a mysterious creation, collections of specific hydrocarbon chains. Farmer and Berlin gave us a laundry list of characteristics of known living systems. And as far back as Schrodinger and von Neumann, at least, little islands of negative entropy of information. And basically, the debate still goes on. And so what I've chosen to do at this point, faced with one essentially unanswerable question, is immediately introduce another and ask, what is mind? So I'm not really doing it part one, part two. It's all lumped together. And for good reason, actually. There's an intimate link between life and mind that I think is unavoidable. So here again, what is mind? Throughout the ages, there have been a lot of insightful and silly answers. Descartes actually did a pretty interesting job of describing fluid in nerve tubes, basically hydraulics. Not entirely too far off. The ancient Greeks said, well, mind is marionettes dangling on strings, and indeed the word neuron is Greek for string. With the Industrial Revolution, well, clearly mind was made up of lots of pulleys and gears. And then with the 1930s, well, we clearly became, mind was just this vast telephone switchboard, all these wires interconnected, good model for mind. That was updated to include, be basically based on Boolean logic as that became popular in the 40s. In the 1960s, the growing ubiquitousness of digital computers, well, obviously the mind was a digital computer and all you had to do was study the programs. In the purple haze following the end of the 60s, mind was obviously a based on holograms. And, well, today I'm here to tell you that thanks to our greater understanding and improved technology, we've finally figured it out and got it right. Well, either that or we're going to have to discuss it some more. Okay, well, that lesson humility absorbed, hopefully. I am going to take an unusual tack in the talk and just give you the answers now. And then we'll get on to some of the background and the implications and the consequences of the definitions I'm about to suggest. First, so life is the word we ascribe to. And I want to point out that I am indeed going now for something that is how you look at a clump of matter and decide whether it's living or non-living. So this really is a definition not based on prior formal theories of life, but based on what we think of when we see something that is alive. It's the word we ascribe to complex dynamical processes that persist. You've heard already from Steve that basically, persistence is a very important aspect of these living systems. But, of course, diamonds persist for a relatively long time. There is this aspect of what we think of as a living system, that there's a certain amount of complex behavior, dynamic behavior, interactions with its environment, and so on. Basically, with enough explanation, caveats, and definitions of these words, I think, however, this is almost sufficient to do it, that it is basically this complex interacting process that continues to survive. However, typically, they reproduce. And indeed, in natural biological systems, we don't have any examples of living things that didn't come out of reproduction and evolution. But I do wonder if it's absolutely essential. To a certain extent, reproduction is just a subset of persistence. It's persistence of a sort of gene line, persistence of a species, as opposed to species persistence of the individual. But nonetheless, it is basically a form of persistence. And then there are fairly reasonable counterexamples to reproducing living systems. I mean, the mule is one that's frequently hauled out. You wouldn't hesitate to call it alive, but it can't reproduce, although it is the end product of the reproduction. So maybe that's not that great an example, but you might also consider an intelligent robot maybe you could say that it understood the concepts of noblesse oblige and gentleman farmer, fashionably out of fashion, belaboring the obvious. Say it shared your sense of humor and some of your musical taste, but perhaps it prefers to read autobiographies and travelogues to your science fictional taste. You'd be sore-pressed to not consider this hypothetical robot alive, but it may have absolutely no concept of no full concept of its own internal structure or the ability to reproduce itself. So reproduction isn't necessarily part of life, but it is typically part of life. And this is just a little bit more explanation. I think I've already given you a little bit of this in defining the initial set of words, but basically we do think that life typically interacts with and adapts to its environment. Sometimes within the lifetime of the organism, learning processes, and sometimes over multiple generations, natural selection. Okay, that does it from life. Let's get on to mind. Well, I was thinking about pulling a fast one here and just unobtrusively switch back and forth between mind and intelligence, but instead I think I'll call attention to the fact that I'm doing this. And because the equivalence of the two terms is interesting in itself, and there's another little piece of it that we frequently throw in when we're talking about mind, especially of higher order intelligence, which is self-awareness. And I think that practical functioning intelligence is actually possible without self-awareness, but it is something that we typically include in higher order systems. And since we're going to define life and mind, I'll throw in where self-awareness comes in a little bit. So let's instead say what intelligence is. It's the word we ascribe to. Okay, again, going for this definition of what we think intelligence is. Complex behavioral responses that foster persistence. Now, this is perfectly resonant with what Steve was saying before about intelligence being things that help organisms persist. And there's a strong resonance with the definition of life, and that's both on purpose in my talk and I think an observation of what's real out here in the world. And typically reproduction. If you think I'm blurring the distinction here between adaptive behavior and intelligence, that's on purpose. I think that you need to think of, I'll return to this, but I think you need to think of intelligence as not something that's peculiar to the human organism, but is rather this complete spectrum from the simplest organisms to the most complex. And we see any form of adaptive behavior that fosters this persistence, fosters the survival of the organism or its gene line, can be thought of as intelligence. So intelligence is what allows a living organism to effectively interact with and adapt to its environment, and it happens to be the bit that applies to within the lifetime of the individual organism. Okay, having dispensed with life and mind and intelligence, I'd like to show why these things are so intimately linked and why they're everywhere you look around you. Evolution is a tautology. Three of them, actually. That which survives persists. Echoing Steve's statement, what Steve said, things that persist, things that don't. And indeed, if it survives, it's going to still be around. This is just you can't avoid it. That which reproduces increases its numbers. So now we're talking about persistence of a gene line, persistence of a species, and things change. Copies are imperfect. The environment changes, so the fitness function changes. And the results of these changes are subject to the first two rules, which is natural selection. So it's really sort of two tautologies and a truism. But evolution is a natural, unavoidable behavior of the right kinds of dynamical systems. Basically, if the physics are right, if there is free energy, and if there are mechanisms for energy storage and transferal, you cannot avoid the natural selection process. Accordingly, it seems intuitively obvious to me that life is the inescapable product of this tautology of evolution, and curiously, so is intelligent life. I think it worth pointing out that the map is not the territory, that one of the benefits that we're seeing in our current time, especially in the field of brain research and neural networks and all that, is that we are finally beginning to study what mind is rather than what mind is like. If you look at that great list of models that I went through of what man has thought mind to be over the ages, they're all metaphors and analogies. Mind is like this, mind is like the other, mind is like that. But we're finally studying the brain. We're looking at the actual physical instantiation. Our hypothesis is that the brain is what the mind is, and we're going in and looking at that, and that's a huge breakthrough, I think, and a great change in our way of thinking about mind. And similarly, I think it's important to study what life is, not what it is like. Now, that does not rule out artificial life. I mean, you might actually think that on first glance, but I'd like to make an analogy with sort of computational fluid dynamics, my sort of first original field of study. There's a book called Horner's Lift and Drag that tells you a whole lot about what fluid flows are like. If you take this bit of wing and you put it next to this bit of fuselage, well, then you're going to get approximately this coefficient of lift and this coefficient of drag. And you can calculate out the entire performance characteristics of an airplane based on these rule of thumb measures. But in the 1970s, we started getting models of what fluid dynamics actually are. The computational models became sufficiently sophisticated that we could actually measure what the fluids were doing. And what we found was that approximations to what fluids actually are valuable. And I think we're seeing the same kind of thing happening now in neural networks, where linear perceptrons, as simple and primitive as they are, kind of like the linearized theory of airflow over airfoils, which was actually a value as a learning tool. Summing and squashing neuron models, like I used in PolyWorld, are kind of like the incompressible fluids. They tell you a lot more about what's going on than linear theory, but they don't capture all the characteristics yet. And more accurate neural models, as we move in, it'll be more like the higher order compressible effects of full-blown fluid flows. And 30 years later, these computational fluid dynamic models are beginning to actually replace wind tunnels. People trust the results of running a numerical simulation more than they trust sticking a model in a wind tunnel. And I think that just as a simulated wind tunnel or a hurricane, as the popular some people have this complaint about artificial life and artificial intelligence that, it's like a hurricane. You can have a simulation of a hurricane, but it'll never make you wet. Well, they're absolutely right, of course, but that's because they're defining it to be a physical phenomenon, the actual raindrops, whereas mind, life, and intelligence are these information processes. It is the process that matters, not the physical phenomenon. And a computer brain will be able to interact with the world the same as you or I will, and I think that we will believe that a computer is alive when it has not been programmed to tell you that it is alive, but it does so anyway. Okay, but maps are good. In particular, maps confer an evolutionary advantage. I think this is that predictability to a certain extent that Steve was talking about, that if an organism has some sense of where it is in the environment, some sense of what the shape of the environment is, this is simply an evolutionary advantage, able to find food, able to find mates, and so on. And a really fascinating thing, I think, is that all it takes is an origin on this map, noticing that the point of view is consistent. If instead of having a fixed map that has a dot roaming around it, if you think of the dot sitting still and the map moving around it, that's the transition to a self-awareness. The location of that origin, the consistent point of view, is the self. And just as organisms learn spatial relationships very early on in order to interact with the environment, the next step is to learn the spatial relationships over a broader field, which is the map, and then the very next logical step is the spatial relationships happen to be centered on the self. Okay, so I say study what is, but I also say learn from what might be, and this is just an only slight paraphrase of what Chris Langton said a long time ago. Artificial life is a study of life as it might be, informing life as it is. And this is very real. It's not just words. If you look at, in fact, I stole this from Chris too. If you look at an origin point in time for what we might consider the first autocatalytic sets, or wherever you want to draw the line and say that this is the beginning of life, you march forward in time. You have all these interesting historical events that happen in this torturous route that life has taken to end up at some point in this large space of what life is today. But a very slight change here might have produced a slight change here, but of course this is a chaotic system, and a very slight change here might have produced a radically different set of what we think of as what life could be today. And never mind that there could be any number of those, or that the origin point could have been entirely different. And so artificial life gives us this opportunity to begin to study all these things that life might be. And Steve and I disagree on perhaps one point, although it's not even much of a disagreement, because I surely would not want to convince him to adopt my approach, nor would I give up my approach to go his way. He stopped a little bit short of announcing it entirely in front of a bunch of evolutionary minds, but from private conversation, I know he believes that engineering really is crucial, really is vital. And he's done some amazing things with creatures and taking an engineering approach to mind and intelligence. But I think artificial life has a strength that shouldn't be overlooked. That it can also be the study of mind as it might be, informing mind as it is. There are a lot of aspects of biological minds, biological brains, that are simply not needed. We don't need much of an autonomic nervous system. We don't need much of a motor cortex. There are huge percentages of the physical matter of our brains that probably aren't going to be needed for functioning, intelligent, artificial organisms. And artificial intelligence, artificial life, allows us to explore some of these entirely different architectures. I mean, you look through the animal kingdom, and the architecture of the nervous system is radically different from organism to organism. They're all based on neurons and synapses, but the architectures are very different, and I think this gives us a chance to explore that space in a very natural fashion. So, I mean, there's a this is the roadmap to artificial life and mind that is sort of at the basis of artificial life. You provide a suitably rich physics, you provide adequate energy, and you invoke evolution, which by its nature produces exactly what we seek. And you wait a long time. So it's perfectly reasonable to think of some shortcuts. Well, we have some good working examples of living organisms around us, so we look at the biology. We use biologically inspired models that provide a rich genetic structure, provide a rich ontogeny. That's perhaps the weakest point in a lot of our systems. Provide a rich environment. Use neural models because all of the examples that we have of intelligence are based on these. Invoke evolution, and we still have to wait, but not nearly as long. So that leads me into just a tiny bit about PolyWorld. And for those who weren't at Digital Biota 1, I was part of the Vivarium program with Alan Kay at Apple Computer, and it has always had this theme of an ecology in the computer, although the primary goal was to look into user interface, how you could have a child in elementary school be able to specify the complex behaviors of a living organism. And some nice artwork that was done up to suggest the kind of the metaphor that they were looking for. And this is kind of what I turned it into. It's not nearly as pretty. But I think there's some decent science in this. I'm going to show you just one single videotape clip, but I thought I'd talk you through the image so you have it happens very quickly and lots going on, give you a clue what you're looking at. Basically, there's this big flat green ground plane. There's these bright green blocks of food growing randomly around the environment. There's these brown barriers that the organisms cannot move through. And these are all the little simulated polyworld organisms. If you've done computer graphics for a while and you can look at a color and go, oh, RGB triple, and just decompose it on the fly, there's actually a lot of information in the image as well, because red is the activation of their fight neuron, blue is the activation of their mate neuron, and green is a genetic marker. You can see very quickly somewhat of the state of the organism. Up at the top, that tiling is the point of view of each individual organism. And in the animation, you'll be able to see, you can, you know, follow one, track it through the world. And that was just for me to sort of reality, sanity check on what the organisms were actually seeing. There's a set of numerical statistics. There's an overhead view that can track an individual organism. And then there's some graphical statistics. Though I'm not going to show the clip that actually shows these things in action, I thought it worth pointing out that the key thing that's being evolved in PolyWorld are the neural architectures of the artificial brains of these things. There's the idea of clusters of neurons, excitatory and inhibitory, with arbitrary connection densities between them, and they can learn or not learn, and at variable rates. And basically, you can specify quite arbitrary brain architectures. And what is important is that these things control the whole of the behavior of the organism, and then that phenotypical behavior of the organism is what actually is ultimately selected on. There's just three snapshots of three entirely different brains. You can see very, very small-minded individual. You can see lots of connections, very, very densely packed, or an even larger brain, but with a lot fewer synaptic connections. What you're looking at, basically, is the neurons at the beginning of a time step, the same neurons at the end of a time step, and this matrix of connections between them. So you get a glimpse of the wiring diagram. That's right, they're completely random. And with that, what came out of some of these simulations, there are a lot of very, very simple species that you can sum up in a word. There are joggers that always run straight ahead and always want to eat and always want to mate, and that's all they do. There's indolent cannibals, so-called, that just basically kill each other and eat each other and reproduce with each other and don't ever do much else. There's edge runners that behaviorally isolate themselves by strictly running around the edges of the world. and therefore don't spread their genes with the other organisms that inhabit the center of the world. And Polyworld was simple enough that at least one and two simulations, those just completely took over the world, and that's all that was left. But that wasn't always the case. There were periods where there were other species roaming around. But I'm just going to cut basically to the final simulation where I think you can see some very interesting sort of the organisms were clearly using their visual system to go out and find food and basically orbit it until they'd finished eating it and then go off to the next block. And also you can see swarms of these things, which is a good way to behave, because you can always find a mate nearby if you're swarming, and you can find food because the swarm drifts. And then some organisms just following and chasing each other. So with that... I fixed enough bugs that it basically just fell out.
So every time you turn it now, you get that.
I get a variety of things. Yeah, I've stopped being able to describe them strictly in terms of a single word. There's a lot going on in this thing. Okay. So... there are some really unfit organisms that will die out very quickly. This is right from the beginning of the simulation, so there's some real crufty stuff, organisms that won't survive for long. But if you watch this guy, or actually there's a bigger one that comes in that's easier to see, you can see it orbits that block of food while it's eating it, goes over and orbits that one and eats that, and keeps doing this, is permanently attracted to food stuff until the swarm distracts it. In the swarm, the behavior is sort of desperately simple. It doesn't take much to describe it, except that they are attracted to each other in their visual field and just keep following each other. There's an organism here that runs the entire length of the world without hitting a block of food, which he won't last long. The behavior is sufficiently complex at this point that I'm not sure exactly why some of them are able to persist for very long. But they are, in fact, reproducing fast enough that they're reproducing the numbers through reproduction rather than me creating additional random organisms. And there was just a little chase to some organisms that ran one after the other. Okay, I mentioned earlier this spectrum of life and intelligence. And I really do think they're intimately bound up, and I really do think it's a spectrum. You can argue, please don't care about where any particular organism is on this pseudo-graph. It's just an expression that, you know, from something like, you know, autocatalytic sets and soup, prebiotic soups up through man, there's kind of a series of a progression of complexity. And now how we get to measuring what complexity is important, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But it's also, interestingly, a direct line of what we think of as the levels of intelligence. I mean, we have adaptive behaviors all the way down at the aplasia level, as was mentioned earlier today, but we see more and more complex adaptive behaviors, more and more complex responses to the environment, and better solutions for persisting as you move up in this order of complexity. And you can look at the complexity in a variety of ways. It can be behavioral complexity. It can be genetic complexity. I think there are some sort of information measures that will be even more useful for letting us actually quantify the degree of life and the degree of intelligence that I'm again going to... I suppose it's worth mentioning that, you know, people haul off the idea of, well, a thermostat... measures its environment, responds to its environment, and changes its environment, so therefore some early definitions of life and intelligence would plonk it down and say it's alive or it's intelligent, and how silly is that, ha-ha. But actually, it's perhaps no sillier than saying that the autocatalytic set is at this end of the spectrum. It's just, you know, it's 0.00001. And that's not a bad thing, and our intelligent robot might very well live out there. And if it's that intelligent, it makes sense indeed to call it alive. So I'm again going to steal from Chris and talk about his lambda parameter. All the way back in ALIFE 2 in 1990, where he looked at a bunch of cellular automata and measured initially this measure of complexity. It was just the length of the transients. If you let this one-dimensional cellular automata do its thing and you look at the traces from it, how long in time does this thing run forward before you get either quenching or repetition? How long do you keep around novel transients? And then plotted that versus this lambda parameter that he made up, which is basically the number of rules in your cellular automata that lead to non-quiescent states divided by the total number of rules. And this is just kind of a schematic diagram of the results that he got, that around some lambda critical, he found that complexity peaked. And unlike Chaitin or Kolmogorov or normalized entropy or some other measure of complexity, it doesn't just increase monotonically with randomness. Rather, there really truly is this peak around this thing. If you measure complexity this way, well, what was really interesting, well, all right, before we get to that, this happens to also correspond to Wolfram's cellular automata classes. It's just sort of a more continuous measure of them. And what's really interesting is that when he did the same studies with mutual information, looking at same cell state in one time step and the next time step, you got basically the same kind of relationship between mutual information and lambda. And given the I double-clicked it by accident. And normalized entropy. Normalized entropy has the bad behavior in measuring complexity that the more random something gets, the larger normalized entropy is going to get. But this mutual information measure doesn't. It has this nice behavior that it captures what you'd have to think of, what I think of as interesting complexity. So I said before that you ought to be able to measure life and intelligence. If you have a box full of stuff, you ought to be able to figure out how alive it is, how intelligent it is. And I think that the right approach to this is this measuring the states of the system and computing the right kind of complexity. Now, what complexity? This mutual information is a good start. There's been some work by other folks at SFI on looking at states of spin glasses that have produced some interesting measures of novelty and measures of complexity. So there's a big research project, but we have some hints that it's possible to define these measures of complexity correctly now, and very simple measures even, possibly. Okay, what state? Well, that depends on your system. Chemical composition, electrical charge are obvious things. But in fact, the value of a software variable is completely equivalent, I think, in some of our artificial life systems. And then in physical systems especially, what scale, it does matter what kind of grid, what you measure your data on. So final tidbit here, I guess, is at Digital Biota 1, I was thinking about, I presented some of that business of spectrum of life and complexity as a measure of life and intelligence, and even was suggesting that we could go out and get real physical data, people doing wet work, doing neural biology work with various organisms. And there's all kinds of horrible problems with normalization and scaling and sparsity of data and so on. But nonetheless, start making measures of complexity of real biological organisms and see if they do fall so gracefully onto a scale. But even if that's sort of really hard to do, if I buy into this hypothesis that this measure, this interesting measure of complexity, is my best quantitative measure of intelligence and of useful complex life, then it occurred to me, well, gee, there might be another really interesting shortcut to doing these A-life simulations. So in addition to the biologically inspired shortcuts, what I was thinking was that you would define the suitable measure of complexity. It has to be well-behaved. We measure the neural states of our system. I'm thinking in terms of polyworld because I know its innards perfectly well. So, okay, we have all these neural states. That's easy to measure. Maybe measure behavioral states all in polyworld. Again, that's not all that different. All their behaviors are the activation of a particular neuron. And then we use complexity directly as the fitness function. Instead of waiting for the populations to grow and shrink and interact and kill each other and reproduce and survive, when it comes time for an organism to be born, we take this measure of the complexity measured over the lifetime of this organism, and we use that as a true, honest-to-gosh fitness function, giving up on some of the pure natural selection mode now. And we say, okay, we know what we want. Our goal is to have something that's more complex in this very specific way, so use that as our fitness function. And I'd hope to actually pursue this line of work this year, but it just hasn't panned out. A couple of potential opportunities didn't work out. Local universities was real interested, and then that didn't work. And I'm just back working on handwriting recognition. So I'm throwing it out to the world that if somebody wants to pursue this, I think this might be the sort of the shortcut that would help an artificial life simulator get to something that was more demonstrably intelligent and more demonstrably alive than just throwing it in a pot and watching it boil. That's it.
Any questions, ladies and gentlemen?
I would still suggest that intelligence and it's worthwhile looking at in the context of the interactions with lots of different organisms. In some sense, what there is to be intelligent about is a function of the world in which an organism lives. So I agree with that, but I think you might want to take a measure on the complexity of the ecological interactions as opposed to the complexity of the individual. So if you're just selecting for complexity on the part of an individual, it's not clear what that complexity is, let's say, useful for.
Well, two answers to that. One is I agree to an extent that, and that's how I was kind of leading to with the behaviors, is that the measuring what goes its interactions with the environment, which is largely composed of other organisms, may be important to this. But I don't think that actually you could have all that useful, interesting interaction with other organisms without it being reflected quite directly in the internal mental states of this neural model. So I think it may not be necessary. You may be able to get the information that's contained in that out of the neural model itself.
It seems like maybe you could get a good general architecture for like how what you know, size and depth of the neural net is based on such design criteria. But I share your worry that you'd be say evolving to a hallucination if you don't have something out there that you're trying against.
May very well be. I suppose if you got sufficiently complex and your internal hallucinatory states were sufficiently complex that might mimic all that complexity without the useful interaction. Something?
I've done some experiments where you confuse the normalized entropy of some behavior, like the sequence of states that it's going through, and then you can set a target entropy and reward it, like around 0.7.
Oh, well, that's very much that's great. I'm sorry, you're trying to go. You.
Do you think it's possible to simulate mind?
Yes. Next. I'm not being facetious, even though I'm being abrupt. That was the point of this, I think. I certainly do believe that. Laughable. Sorry. I
I have the impression you're quite weighted to neural nets, and it seems to me that one of the things about human beings is that although we probably use neural nets for all kinds of things, like reversing a car into another space,
where there are lots of continuous transformations in the net. When I'm doing algebra or logic or debugging a computer program, it feels to me that if I'm, I've got stored formulae and rules and things that don't necessarily require neural net, even though maybe neural nets are deep down the implementation in my brain. And it may be that the evolution of something different played a crucial role in our development. Now, is that something, a new brain, naturally, that's what we've got. But perhaps what it actually does could be implemented without neural nets.
That it's entirely possible that it could be implemented without neural nets, I suppose. It's just that our best working example is neural nets, and you answered, you gave the answer I was going to give you, which is that that even if we're working with symbols, and as important as symbols may be for certain operations, it's obviously, to the best of our knowledge, it is obviously embedded in a big neural net. So that still seems like a viable approach. Seems like the most viable approach I know. Oh, you can do mathematics. You can do mathematics much more efficiently in a computer than you can do it in your brain. Well, we all, this is painfully true. Yes, but AI has taken that approach for a long time now and done quite horribly.
And it's doing very well in lots of commercial applications.
It is? Well, I mean, it's in a very specific limited domain. In a sufficiently limited domain, I have no doubt that our expert systems have done great things. They told you how to configure a DEX system a long time ago. It has proven to be a valuable technology. But again, that knowledge that did not represent anything useful about a knowledge of the world outside of that very limited domain, and it wasn't a particularly effective learning mechanism, all of that information that got into that was by query and response, that the nature of the expert system. And I just don't see that as a useful approach to doing anything that's... I mean, Doug Lennett was trying to do that. I don't know what his current status is, but that's what psych was all about. Say, okay, to me, that was the last great gasp of symbolic approach to AI.
That you could expect everything in one simple formalism. I mean, let's not have this debate now, because the only point I want to make is, which I think you've already agreed, that there might be a variety of mechanisms that have played a role in our evolution, and perhaps...
Well, I don't know that they've played much of a role in our evolution. I mean, I think our evolution is of the neural nets, basically.
No, that's a mechanism at a low level. There are other mechanisms that might be implemented in that. That's the point.
I think a reasonable answer on Larry's part is that, yeah, sure, I think that that's true. There could be many other formalisms, but within any one of those formalisms, one ought to be able to study these kinds of phenomena, take the kinds of measures that we're looking for. So neural nets is maybe as good a choice as
I think we have time for one more question. And answer the question.
Oh, one. You finessed one thing.
One? Thank you.
You said mind is intelligence plus self-awareness, and then it didn't seem like you said much of self-awareness.
The only thing I did have to say about is the map business. I don't think I made that up. I think I heard that somewhere. It just seems so straightforward that organisms have to learn to interact spatially with the world, and that happens at a very primitive. This occludes that, and then if I reach my arm out this far, I can touch this thing. It's the early flailing of the infant, and it's something that all organisms learn to some extent. Then it's not that big a stretch to imagine that interaction with the world extending to a larger domain, basically the map of the environment, and then it's not that big a stretch to imagine that all of those observations coming from a central point force the system to have a referent, have the origin of the map, and it doesn't take anything more than that to be a self.
This podcast is covered by Creative Commons. If you use this podcast either in audio or text form, Please include a link back to biota.org as the source of this podcast. I'm Tom Barbalay, and if you're interested in more artificial life-related stuff, please subscribe to the biota.org mailing list. Thank you very much for tuning into this podcast. Look forward to you tuning into the next podcast.